This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And if you're out there driving, keep your eyes on the road. You want to be able to drive and listen to the Takeaway at the same time. But this hour, some technological solutions to the predicament of the digital world driving people straight to distraction. And that's dangerous. Can tech get us out of the distracted driving problem that tech got us all into? We'll talk about that. But most of this hour, we will be thinking about a defendant who is now a convicted felon, but maybe more importantly, is now a symbol of the possible limits of free speech in an age where government secrets are just a mouse click away from being uploaded to a digital screen in Times Square for all to see. Private First Class Bradley Manning will spend the rest of his life being referred to as someone convicted of espionage for leaking more than 700,000 pages of secret government documents. He was convicted yesterday on those charges, but acquitted of the charge of aiding the enemy. The sentencing phase of his trial begins today in Fort Meade, Maryland. Private Manning also gave the global hacker insurgent Julian Assange a world stage for his assault on government secrecy called WikiLeaks. Manning testified at his eight-week trial that he wanted to start a debate among U.S. citizens about the practice of warfare, the tactics of counterinsurgency, and to open the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to more public scrutiny. Manning also testified that he offered to give his leaked documents to the New York Times and the Washington Post before he went to WikiLeaks. With us is Bill Keller, columnist for our partner in the New York Times and former executive editor at the Times. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Do you think this case would have been any different had the New York Times and the Washington Post been the ones to publish the leaks from Private Manning versus WikiLeaks?
I think there would have been a case anyway. There was no way the military was going to look the other way at a young man in uniform in the field of battle. I mean, he did this leaking sensitive documents about the war. So in that respect, I don't think it would have been all that different. You know, I've tried to speculate a bit about what it would have been like if he'd found his way into the insides of the New York Times instead of to WikiLeaks. I mean, one of the things that happened as a result of WikiLeaks' dissemination of these documents is that some stuff got out that probably shouldn't have. Identification of confidential sources, dissidents and people who speak to Americans in countries where that could put them in peril. We were quite careful about laundering out any names that could get people hurt, but some of them did leak out because the documents were so widespread. I think also there is an sort of added animus, unfairly, but really aimed at Bradley Manning because of his alliance with WikiLeaks, which is perceived as a kind of hacker, anarchist, anti-American outfit. And that contributes to this aura that what Manning did is not only criminal, but somehow traitorous.
You know, it's interesting. Some time has passed since we first together began discussing the implications of WikiLeaks and what Bradley Manning leaked to WikiLeaks. Do you think the trends in the media, the trends online, the trends in information flow generally push WikiLeaks away from this insurgent, anarchist, outsider identity into more of an insider, almost a subscription model, another form of information not unlike the New York Times or maybe closer to a New York Times and Washington Post than what it originally cast itself as?
No, actually, I don't think that. I mean, when you take a sort of snapshot today of where WikiLeaks is, its founder is living in a room in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, avoiding extradition to Sweden. I said at the time that it was hard to imagine what the next WikiLeaks would be, that this would be a precedent for anything. How often are you going to get the combination of a disgruntled army private with access to all of these classified documents and willing to take the risks that he took to deliver them to the world? And there hasn't been another Bradley Manning until Edward Snowden, who is, as you said earlier, at least on a kind of comparable scale.
Let's talk about Manning. What do you think of him? If he was a source, would you consider him a brave character in the annals of free speech and the media confrontation of authority as he is now? What do you make of him as a symbol?
He's become a very polarizing figure in the political discussion. I mean, his lawyer portrayed him as a naive idealist. The prosecutor described him as a kind of self-important anarchist. If you read the comments that are appended to all the news articles, you'll find, free Bradley Manning followed by hang Bradley Manning. I think he's a complicated young man. I don't think he's either Benedict Arnold or Nathan Hale. And his motives are a very human mix of somewhat vague political aspirations to fix the world and a lot of personal unhappiness. I mean, one of the interesting things about this is it doesn't get mentioned much, but I think 15 other people have been disciplined in this case, obviously not to the extent that he's been punished, but have been disciplined mainly for failing to see that Bradley Manning was not somebody who should have access to classified information.
Mm. More complicated Bradley Manning than someone like Daniel Ellsberg, for instance, who leaked the Pentagon Papers to New York Times and the Washington Post for various kinds of reasons, a character who had personal animus as well as a political agenda?
Well, there is an interesting documentary that came out recently by a filmmaker named Robert Greenwald called War on Whistleblowers. And there are a number of striking things that these classic whistleblowers have in common. One is they have a very clear abuse that has caught their attention that they think is outrageous. Second thing is they have a very clear motive. They are going to, one way or another, root out this wrongdoing. And the third one is that they try first to fix it within the system. I mean, even Daniel Ellsberg, before he came to the New York Times, went to Congress and tried to get them interested in the secret history of the war in Vietnam. None of those factors apply to Bradley Manning. That doesn't mean, you know, that it's wrong to call him a whistleblower. I don't know what label you want to put on him, but it does mean that it's a somewhat different situation from the sort of classic whistleblower modus operandi.
Fascinating. Well, Bill Keller, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bill Keller is former executive editor for The New York Times. Currently, he's an op-ed columnist for The Times. Bradley Manning's family issued this statement yesterday after the verdict. You may have heard it. While we are obviously disappointed in today's verdicts, we are happy that Judge Lind agreed with us that Brad never intended to help America's enemies in any way. Brad loves his country and was proud to wear its uniform. Here are some facts, though. Bradley Manning, after years of a troubled family life, an aimless work history, and conflicts within himself and his family over being gay, Manning reported for basic training in the U.S. Army in October of 2007. Less than a year later, he was an intelligence analyst with a top-secret clearance. A year after that, he was in Baghdad. Weeks into his deployment, he was reportedly looking for ways to contact WikiLeaks. In early 2010, he downloaded classified files, carried them back to the U.S. on leave, where he eventually uploaded them to WikiLeaks in February of 2010. By July of that year, he was charged with espionage and in the custody of military authorities. 3 years later, a verdict for Manning, a global identity for WikiLeaks, and now a new case, Edward Snowden, has again challenged government secrecy and mobilized U.S. authorities to go after a leaker. With us now, Elizabeth Goitein, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program at the NYU Law School. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Thinking about the sentencing now, and that all begins in Fort Meade today, is there an option for Judge Lind of time served here on all of these convictions?
Well, she really is quite free to set the sentence that she thinks is appropriate. It's a little different from the civilian sentencing system. There are no sentencing guidelines. There is no minimum sentence that she needs to impose. Manning has already been credited 112 days for time served based on the fact that the conditions of his pretrial confinement were found to be very inappropriate. So she really has the full range available to her from, you know, a slap on the wrist to 136 years.
That's amazing. How does motive figure into the sentencing here that was much talked about by the defense in the trial? And defense, on some level, scored a victory yesterday against the government.
You could say that, although I'm not sure that Bradley Manning necessarily feels that way as he faces 136 years
right,
in prison.
Exactly.
But it's true that motive will finally be relevant at the sentencing stage when it really was not relevant throughout the trial, according to the judge. And her interpretation of both the aiding the enemy charge and the Espionage Act charges was that the government did not need to prove that Bradley Manning had bad faith or that he intended to harm the United States or to help the enemy. And even under the aiding the enemy charge, which she acquitted Manning of that charge, She held that the government only had to prove that Manning knew that the information that he was disclosing basically would get to al-Qaeda. And it didn't matter if that was his intent and that's what he wanted and whether he wanted to do harm by that. So there really was the bar for what the government had to prove was actually quite low. And so it's, you know, says a lot that the government wasn't even able to prove that on the aiding the enemy charge.
Interesting. At this point, does this case speak more to the question of the limits of government secrets and the First Amendment? Or is it more about, and Judge Lynn seemed to refer to this, issues like why the heck did you give this disturbed fellow a top secret security clearance, that sort of thing?
Well, it's a trial of Manning right now. He is the one that's being charged. And so the issue is, you know, whether what he did is illegal. And there's a secondary issue, really, that I think we need to look at, which is whether it should be illegal and whether our laws for dealing with national security leaks have gotten to a point where they no longer, if they ever did, appropriately distinguish among all the different kinds of national security leaks, because you do have leaks that are harmful to the United States that are intended to aid the enemy. And then you have leaks of information that never should have been classified in the first place that are done with absolutely no ill intent. And then you have everything in between. And the problem right now is that the law, or at least as it's being applied by the courts, doesn't appear to make much of a distinction.
Finally, let's pretend for a moment you're Edward Snowden's lawyer today. Based on this verdict, what's the first thing you do or advise Edward Snowden if he was actually in military custody?
If he were in military custody? I mean, I don't think Edward Snowden is going to military custody, and that's something that Attorney General Holder has said, that he would be tried in a civilian court. So right there, I think things would look a little different. But if I were Snowden's attorney, I'd be nervous. I mean, I think what we're seeing in this case is the continuing trend of motive being dismissed essentially as irrelevant, certainly at the guilt phase of the trial. And really, motive is what distinguishes someone like Edward Snowden from someone who traditionally has been subject to the Espionage Act and charges like that.
Hmm. Elizabeth Goitein is the co-director of the Brennan Center, on Liberty and National Security. It's a program of the NYU Law School. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So lots of you out there have been weighing in with your opinions of Bradley Manning.
Hillary, and I'm from Boston. I believe that Private Manning is a hero. He did make the American public aware of what's really going on with our drone program and how many innocent lives are being lost.
You can weigh in, 877-8-MY-TAKE, be a part of the conversation. And where are we headed next?
Recalculating, recalculating, recalculating.
When we're behind the wheel, how much should we worry about all those gadgets up front there in the dashboard? Coming up here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You know, we're getting to the point where you could be driving along on a road somewhere and someone could text a top secret document to you right in your car and you just drive off the road.
Recalculating.
The intrusive digital distractions in our cars are both part of the 21st century background noise of life itself, and they are an intentional product of bringing our electronic world into our cars. Remember, cell phones were originally called car phones. What will reverse the distraction factor? Car makers have started offering voice-activated systems that let drivers compose hands-free emails and text messages in their cars and even make updates on Facebook. But this may be about freeing your mind as much as freeing your hands there in the driver's seat. Kara Miller has been exploring all of this as host of the show Innovation Hub, produced by our partner, WGBH in Boston. Kara, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So let's tackle this question of hands-free versus mind-free. Can the brain do what the car company's new technologies suggest we might safely do?
I think the bottom line is the research suggests no. But what's amazing is that, you know, AAA has said there is an arms race in the car amongst car manufacturers to basically make your car an extension of your tablet, of your home office, right? So it's kind of a rolling laptop that comes with you everywhere. And you see almost every car manufacturer getting into this. So Ford, for example, has a system called Sync. It lets you control your phone apps by speaking. It will read you texts. It actually understands emoticons, right? So when somebody sends you that smiley face, it gets it. It also has this screen in the center. The idea is it's supposed to be in the dashboard so you can still look at the road and check out your music library and check out your phone contacts. But as you say, the real question is, how do our minds do with this?
And there are some skeptics. Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, is not terribly confident that we can both watch the road and have an emotional relationship with our dashboard. Listen.
Even when we have a technology that allows us to speak texts, even that is very distracting in a way that I don't think we're so conscious of, because we assume that if our eyes are focused out on the road, that the fact that we're composing something in our mind probably doesn't intrude on our attentiveness, whereas in fact it does.
So hands-free, head full still leads to distracted driving, Kara.
Yet what we see actually is this avalanche of research coming together over the past few years to show that when your hands are on the wheel, it doesn't mean your mind is on the road. So researchers from Toronto actually looked at brain activity when you're doing different things in the car. And it turns out that when you're on the phone, even if it's hands-free, that the part of your brain that governs space and thinking about depth perception, the activity has moved out of that area into the place where there's sort of deep cognitive thinking, right? Because somebody's probably saying, let me help you think through a problem, or let's talk about this. And so you've sort of lost the ability to really drive in a clear way. There's some fascinating stuff out of Virginia Tech that actually layers the problems of distraction. So it turns out that applying makeup and dialing are the absolute worst things you can do. They tend to triple your likelihood of being in an accident. The easiest things to do are to like sip a cup of coffee and smoke, apparently, in the car. And then in the middle, with things that double your likelihood of getting in an accident are talking, listening, eating, and like putting in a CD.
And so, you don't need an fMRI to conclude that this is a problem. I mean, if somebody's talking to you about, oh, wouldn't it be great to go to a beach resort somewhere, suddenly your visual parts of your brain are thinking about that as much as the road. What's fascinating to me is that the tension here is we want to be safe, but there's also a huge demand for this kind of technology in the cars, according to Clifford Nass, who co-directs the Center for Automotive Research at Stanford.
The automotive industries are pulling their hair out. On the one hand, people are dying for more and more screens in the car, more and more content in the car. At the same time, they're on the road and cars aren't fully autonomous yet or automated, that they don't have to pay attention. People get in the habit of mind of using multiple media at one time. Even when they try to look at one thing, their brains in some sense don't allow it.
Or their kids in the back seat don't allow it. If they're screaming, there's all kinds of distractions here.
Yeah, I mean, there's a professor at the University of Utah who tested what it does to your brain to be talking on the phone. And it turns out that talking on the phone is like driving with a 0.08 blood alcohol level, which in many states is over the limit. So, I mean, it really, really, and people think exactly as Clifford Nass said, people think I can totally do it. I am not distracted. And that's, in a way, the danger.
So the driverless car is the solution here, right?
Yeah. I think it is. I would love a driverless car because I feel like, so personally, I think it would kind of free you up to do other things in the car. Traffic doesn't matter as much. And the amazing thing about the driverless car is it seems like it is coming to a garage near you. Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, which is famous for having driven its own driverless car hundreds of thousands of miles, done really, really well, he thinks they're going to be on the market by 2017. I mean, that is really soon. But then you also have other companies that are getting into the act here, and they are piece by piece, trying to get in little bits of driverless driving into cars. They're already working with Volvo, GM, and so there's going to be little bits of this. So, for example, one thing that they're working on is if a pedestrian comes out in front or behind your car, the driverless function will take over and make sure you don't hit the pedestrian.
So,
it'll look at the blind spot.
So part-time hybrid driverless cars as a prelude to the actual driverless car. And it sounds like I'm going to have to stand in line behind you, Kara, for one of these driverless cars.
Huh? I'm sorry. I mean, currently they're $150,000, so I'm not in line yet. But
you do work for public radio.
Yeah, exactly. I think in 10 or 15 years, it could be here. That's the amazing thing.
Kara Miller, host of the Innovation Hub for our partner, WGBH. A listener in Birmingham, Michigan, Ford needs to work on her, the sync function. She never understands me, and when she does, she's not very nice to me. Having a tech relationship with your car, we'd love to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us about the distractions in your dashboard.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Here in my car, I feel safest of all. I can lock all my doors. It's the only way to live in
our story from Refugee Nation today comes from Somalia, and a woman who barely remembers the place and can only think of her home from where she lives in Kenya. For two decades, Somalia has been at war with itself. In the worst of that war, Farhia Shaz Hussein became a refugee, joining what is now a nation of the displaced, 45 million strong. The United Nations said this month that it was prepared to say tentatively that this is a moment of hope for Somalia and its hundreds of thousands of refugees around the world, including most of the estimated 90,000 Somalis in the U.S. in our radio audience in the Twin Cities area. Today, refugee Farhia Shaz Hussein is a young woman who possibly symbolizes that hope for the displaced people of Somalia. She is a volunteer and ambassador at Refugees United, Nairobi, Kenya.
I moved from Somalia when I was 1 year old. I remember I grew up in Kakuma camp. It is me plus my 7 siblings and my mom. We left my dad in Somalia. And when I was 6 years old, I was in the camp. I lost my family, like my mom and my 7 siblings. I don't know where they are right now. I was in a boarding school, and when I went back home, there was no one at home. And then there was a grandmother, a Somali grandmother, Somali Kenyan, who took care of me. So she moved me from Kakuma camp to Nairobi.
Do you remember where you would play, what you would do, friends you had, the place where you lived? Give me a sense of what it was like to grow up in Kakuma camp.
Yes, I remember. I remember everything. I remember the school. I remember the playground. We used to play with balls and actually tires.
And when you look back, what is your identity as a refugee? You've lived all of your life moving from place to place. Do you feel like a Kenyan? Do you feel like a Somali? Do you want to go home to Somalia, if such a thing is even possible?
Actually, I speak good Swahili, and I speak good English, and I also speak Somali. So it's like I'm half Kenyan, half Somali.
What do you think the world needs to know about the experience of the 45 million refugees or displaced people in the world today?
Actually, being a refugee is not something that is easy, because actually you're not in your country. You're not free, like you can do anything you feel like. And being a refugee, we know that a refugee can't work. So you can't work in a foreign country. You have to be a refugee. So it's not something easy.
Is there a place you'd want to go? Is there a place you'd want to live? Is there a dream that you have of a job that you might have somewhere?
Yeah, of course. Although we are refugees, we are just human beings. So, and I think every human being has a dream. And actually, for me personally, I would like to help my fellow refugees, because I know how it feels like.
Do you see yourself as representing refugees in the organization that you work for?
Yes, actually, I work for Refugees United. and Refugees United is a non-profit independent organization with a mission of trying to reconnect thousands of separated refugees across the globe. So I personally know how it feels like if you don't have a family. So Refugees United is doing a great job trying to reconnect those families who lost contact.
Do you think you'll ever see your family again?
Before, I never used to think that I'll get my family, because now if you see me, like, I don't know Somalis, I don't know where Mogadishu is. And actually, I've never went back. So I never used to have hope that I'll meet my family. But with Refugees United, then I know that one day I will get my family. It gave me a new ray of hope. So I know that it also gives some other refugees the same hope that they'll meet their loved ones.
Farhia Shaz Hussain, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Farhia Shaz Hussain is a volunteer and ambassador at Refugees United in Nairobi. She's from Somalia and has been a refugee since she was 1 year old. As I mentioned, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, said this month that this is a moment of hope for the people of Somalia. Hope, perhaps, for some 1.1 million internally displaced persons and over 1 million more living in exile, like Farhia Shaz Hussain, in neighboring countries, mostly Kenya, Ethiopia, and Yemen. But holding the UN accountable for that moment of hope and reminding the world that there is much work left to do to recover Somalia from 2 decades of civil war will be the work of brave journalist Mustafa Haji Abinur. He's the reporter on the ground in Mogadishu for Agence France-Presse, AFP. Mustafa was in New York City earlier this month, where he spoke to the United Nations about threats to journalists around the world. He stopped by our studios to talk about the uncertainties of reporting each day from Somalia and how sometimes it's hard to see rays of hope in his own country.
It's quite complicated, really, being a journalist in Somalia to report from a Mogadishu, city like Mogadishu, where you don't know your enemy and everybody's not pleased with the media. So it's really terrible that every day that journalist is being killed, being harassed, being arrested. So it is very difficult, really. It's not something that you can imagine.
What was your most difficult moment in Somalia in terms of being in harm's way?
Well, when I got, like, a friend of mine being killed a few blocks away from where I stayed, I could have had the shots. And then when I got out just to get to what's happening out there, I find out that he was my friend who was being shot dead. And I find out it's been bleeding, the ground, and then I saw a friend coming towards me saying that, okay, this is your friend being killed, so please go run away. Don't be here. So it's really very, very shocking.
One of the things you said before the United Nations, which I thought was extraordinary, was, I know you folks hate us as journalists.
Yeah.
Just don't kill us. Yeah. What did you mean by that?
I might be referring to the government. You know, you never know who your enemy is. Whoever is not pleased with what you say can be your enemy. You don't please everybody if you are a journalist. Today, if you're just talking about something and somebody's not pleased with it, simply you can piss them off. So the idea is that if you're pissed off, you can hate us, but don't kill us. The rest of the world would not be hearing about Somalia if all the journalists are being killed or being forced to flee. And if this continues to be like this, the news is already dead. Yeah.
You know, the United States' unsuccessful attempt to take Mohammed Farah Aidid, the warlord, that became known as the Black Hawk Down incident, was the moment where the United States kind of said enough with Somalia. Do you get a sense that the U.S. just isn't interested in Somalia because of that experience and others like it?
If you ask me my idea, that's what I sense. Because if you look at what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Afghanistan, and how the U.S. is interested and how they are now interested in Somalia's situation, it's a bit quite different. They are giving a very little attention to the Somali situation rather than the other countries they are involved, militarily or politically or whatever. And that's also what's prolonging the Somali situation like this. Maybe if the U.S. had a lot of involvement in the Somali situation, it might help more than it does now.
What do you think the scenario is for change in Mogadishu, in Somalia?
The best scenario is that Somalia gets into order. Somalia had no government for 21 years, and so far we don't have an effective government. We don't have police, we don't have army that's effective. I mean, so Somalia, it's like a chaos country, a place where you don't have law and order.
Well, it's remarkable that you've managed to stay as long as you have and have been as effective as a reporter both in Somalia and getting your voice out through the news agency AFP. Mustafa Haji Abdinur, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Economists may have been doing some all-nighters recently to change the way economic activity is calculated. The gross domestic product, or GDP, is the global yardstick for measuring economic growth country to country, state to state. But simply adding up the value of all goods and services misses a few things. The recalculation may amount to moving the goalposts for some nations in the industrialized world who may suddenly get a boost for some less than cash on the barrelhead assets like intellectual property, licensing fees, royalties, investments in research and development. With us to explain all this is Robert Armstrong, editor of the U.S. Lex column at the Financial Times. Welcome, Robert.
Hi.
So who benefits from this recalculation? Does the U.S. get a big boost because some things that weren't measured will be now?
The U.S. economy will get bigger. But I want to use that phrase carefully, right? Because it gets accounting bigger, not real world bigger. And when you know, just as for a company or a person, you change the way you record your wealth, it doesn't make you richer or poorer. It's just an exercise in trying to measure your wealth more accurately.
So what are we swallowing here? A Luxembourg, an Australia?
Belgium.
Really?
So we get Belgium, roughly Belgium bigger, as my colleague at the FT put it. And this kind of shift happens all the time in businesses, right? There's two ways a business can spend money. You can have an expense or you can have an investment. And you're still spending money in both cases, but I invest in paying for a truck. It's a long-lived asset. It generates money. I'm richer because I own a truck. Or I can just expense, and it's just a cost of doing business. I pay for your lunch or for my salary, and that's just money out the door. And so that's the difference. We're going from an expense model of certain kind of expenditures to an investment model.
Does this underrepresent nations like China and Brazil and India that are big, big in manufacturing and in traditional businesses?
Yes. So let's think about an iPhone, right? You have a bunch of casually dressed geeks in California thinking up software, and then you have people in China putting the thing together, and you have people in Japan and Germany doing the high-tech chips and so forth. And so the value add of that thing is spread all over the world. But the R&D investment is likely to be mostly here in the United States. And the manufacturing, the hard, you know, the sort of hard nuts and bolts part of it is going to be elsewhere.
So until this new calculation, is it the case that most of the GDP impact of something like an iPhone was really in Asia, not really in the United States? And all of a sudden, that's going to be a chunk of GDP that comes back across the ocean?
Well, it's hard to say, but there's no question that recorded wealth is going to be shifting towards Silicon Valley and away from some other places.
Who clamors for this sort of thing? How routine is a review of how these statistics are calculated?
Well, they do a big review every 5 years at the federal level. And if you think about this in the broadest possible way, a change like this makes a lot of sense. More of the value being added to our economy is in intellectual property now than it once was. Software is more important. Hardware is becoming commoditized, right? So it only makes sense that the way we measure our economy should change as our economy changes. However, this is also a great opportunity for the raving conspiracy theorists of the world to say that the government is trying to inflate the size of economy to make things look better, even though in reality they're awful.
Is there virtue in keeping things very conservative, really only focusing on tangible benefits? Because when downturns happen, when you're looking in the ether sometimes, and we saw this in the financial meltdown, that when things don't exist, they really don't exist.
Yes. And, a piece of software can lose value quite quickly when it's superseded. So the accounting has to be good, right? When something loses value, you have to write it down or depreciate it. And so there are new challenges to the accounting here. The accounting here is going to be trickier, require more judgment. There probably will be more room for mistakes. But the alternative is covering your ears and humming and pretending we still live in the economy of 60 years ago.
Final question, and maybe it's a little personal. I don't want to cause any emotion here, but are we getting to the point where you mentioned intellectual property, that there may actually be a value attached to journalists and all of the thoughtful things they come up with at the FT and elsewhere?
I certainly hope so.
That's a hard one.
But that's the right kind of question to be asked. What does the FT own? After our paper or our website runs one day and then all that stuff slips into the past.
Or this radio show, for that
matter.
Right,
this radio show. And so, but remember, however you account for that stuff, the real world challenge remains the same, which is WNYC is sitting there, or the Financial Times is sitting there thinking, we do all this intellectual work. How do we turn that into cash? Right? And however we account for it.
Of course, governments do that all the time. Right. Their intellectual work becomes taxes. Yeah. They turn it into cash all the time.
But, you change the measurement, the ground level challenge of businesses and enterprises and countries remain the same, which is you do all this work, you think really hard. How are you going to get paid?
Robert Armstrong is the editor of the U.S. Lex column at the Financial Times, talking about moving the goalposts, recalculating the gross domestic product. Robert, thanks.
Thank you.
I love this little bit of a consensus from you distracted drivers out there this hour. It would be great if the car tech actually worked, some of you are saying. Calling through the car Bluetooth, it takes like 20 minutes to get it to call. Okay, not quite, but still, says one of you from Fort Worth, Texas. I'm a daredevil by nature, says one of you from Denver, but getting the Bluetooth stereo receiver in my dashboard to synchronize with my smartphone while driving is probably the most dangerous thing I've ever done. Who hates the pinging noise that says your keys are still in the ignition? That's one of you from San Antonio. And for one of you in Lakeland, Florida, it's the car alarm. I cut the wires, literally, you texted. Not while driving, I hope. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your distracted driving stories. Unanimity, though, from you guys about how convicted felon Bradley Manning should be treated. On Facebook, Susan, since Iraq never was the enemy in the first place, how could he be guilty of aiding and abetting the enemy? Bravo, Private Manning. You will go down in history as a hero. Alwyn says Manning is technically guilty of doing things he was charged with doing, things that he has confessed to doing. It is precisely because he did them that we owe him a debt of gratitude, says Alwyn. It takes bravery to blow a whistle on the U.S. government, especially under the terms of military service. Well, we will examine that proposition coming up. First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams, who defended the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, will be with us. Stay with us. Reach out to us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Back to Private Manning now. His verdict, is he a hero? Is he a whistleblower? Is he a leaker? Is he a saboteur? He's a convicted felon. In our conversation with the New York Times columnist Bill Keller earlier this hour, we raised the question of whether Bradley Manning resembles the senior statesman of whistleblowers in our time, Daniel Ellsberg, the man behind the Pentagon Papers. He worked for the Rand Corporation, leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and the Washington Post back in the 1970s. Bill Keller thought Ellsberg and Manning were quite distinct cases, but what does the lawyer who defended the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case before the U.S. Supreme Court think about Manning and this verdict? Legendary First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams joins us. Counselor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be here.
You know, let's talk first about this question of motive, which came up at the trial, which will be more relevant than the sentencing. There was also an issue of the troubled life of Daniel Ellsberg in trying to evaluate his motive. Do you think motive comes into question here as we move forward in thinking about government secrecy and the First Amendment?
motive is relevant in a criminal law context in terms of the application of the First Amendment, I don't really think it should have a lot to do with it. I mean, things should either be allowed or not allowed, or more important, protected or not protected under the First Amendment. And I'm sort of reluctant to have the courts get into motive as a way of determining where and if the First Amendment applies.
Do you think there's an irony or a coincidence in the narrative of personal troubles in the case of Daniel Ellsberg? Of course, his psychiatrist's office was burglarized by the Nixon administration, which became a whole big issue itself. And, of course, the facts in the case about Bradley Manning and his troubles with his family, his troubles being gay in the military, all these sorts of things that came up in the trial. Is that narrative important at all?
It's really interesting in terms of how important it is. I think the sort of person, I say in a non-pejorative way, the sort of person who would be willing to or led to release 700,000 documents, many of them classified, would more likely than not be someone who's somewhat estranged from American society, either because of mistreatment of him or an acute sense of willingness, to pass a sort of judgment that most people don't even think about.
So here's the million-dollar question. Does the First Amendment protection create a sanctuary for such people who are likely maybe to pull the trigger on some questionable behavior that does result, for good or ill, in protecting Americans, extending our notion of democracy?
Well, there is likely, and I say likely because there really have been a lot of cases in this area, but likely going to be more First Amendment protection for people who act with innocent motive. That is to say, if you're really doing something to help an enemy, which was not the case here, but if that's really your motive, then that's relevant on every level. Even as we sit in personal judgment, the law aside, just what do we think of the person? How do we think the person behaved? If the person behaved with the purpose of aiding a foreign country, we're more likely, I am in any event, to think more harshly of him. Mm.
Where does this put the Edward Snowden case, do you think? Where does this put a possible conspiracy case against Julian Assange himself, the founder of WikiLeaks?
I think that there's a mixed verdict here. The government has sustained a very significant defeat in trying its very expansive reading of aiding the enemy. I mean, that's a very major thing that's happened, and I think we ought to give some credit to the judge for personal bravery. I mean, a sitting colonel. In a situation like this, under great pressure, whether or not anyone ever talked to her about it, but under great pressure, has come out in a more, civil libertarian-oriented way, or at least a way that unwilling to read this statute to cover what was done here.
And yet she said the burden of proof was low for the government. They didn't even meet that, in her opinion.
Yes, yes. And what that shows, I think, is the I don't want to say misconduct, but that the level of passion of the Department of Justice in this case overcame good judgment. They never should have charged him with aiding the enemy. It was wrong to do that.
By overreaching, they create a distraction and they get away from the real issues in the case.
Yeah. I mean, we can argue about what the real issues are. He's obviously guilty of some of these things.
He's pled guilty to
some of them. It'll be really interesting to see what sort of sentence she imposes because certainly a lot of the guilty findings yesterday were so overlapping in nature, so much the same conduct again and again and again, that it would be really wrong to sentence, a life sentence for something like this.
Is there a constitutional question that we need to maybe think about changing our notion of the First Amendment to deal with the kinds of digital leaks in this classified domain that now is going to be more increasingly likely. And that data is going to be available in ways that was never envisioned by the framers.
Now, that's true. Look, we start with the notion that historically, even First Amendment lawyers didn't really argue there was a First Amendment right to leak. We've argued there was a First Amendment right to receive, to pass on, to comment on, of course, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there's never been viewed as much of a First Amendment presence of a government employee in a position of trust and authority, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we've moved, as you say, to a situation in which, you know, Dan Ellsberg wouldn't have to go to the New York Times today. He could just get it all online.
Open a web page.
Sure.
Yeah.
And he could do it anonymously or find a way to do it anonymously. So, I mean, an enormous amount has changed. I don't think the First Amendment side has changed. It's just that the First Amendment side may be less relevant in a lot of ways. The First Amendment would come into play if they prosecute WikiLeaks or Assange. I mean, there, if the government were to say what you were positing a moment ago, if the government were to say, well, we're now going after Assange on an aiding and abetting charge, that would threaten every journalist who talks to people in possession of, quote, secret, unquote, information and really imperil the flow of news to the public.
And it sounds like that would be a case you would be interested in taking one way or another without prejudicing one way or another. Floyd Abrams, thanks so much for being here.
It's good to be here.
Floyd Abrams is the First Amendment lawyer who defended the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case of the 1970s. Lots of reactions from you to the Bradley Manning trial verdict. Is he a hero? Is he a traitor?
Yeah, this is Jenny from Edna, Kansas. I think the American people pay taxes and support the military complex, and we should know what they're up to.
Transparency, says Jenny. Thanks so much for that. John tells us on Facebook, I agree with the verdict. He did not aid the enemy, and he is a sort of hero for helping expose what he did, but he also violated his duty in doing so and deserves some punishment for his breach of trust. We hope you can join us same time tomorrow, where we will be in the great city of Atlanta broadcasting from Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.